I think I have the rest of his
history. To get a master's at Wheaton and then his PhD at Oxford, and is now dean of the College of Honors Studies.
The Schreyer Honors College at Penn
Schreyer
State. Yeah.
Yes, so he's doing great things, and tonight he'll be talking to us about pain and suffering and Christian responses to that. So without further ado, yes.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So I'll probably give you a little bit more of my bio, if that's all right, because it informs where I'm coming from. And it's a little bit trite, but it's nonetheless true to say that we do not know as much today as we will know tomorrow, no matter what our age is. And this past week, I had an angry father who wrote me upset that his beautiful, precious son, who's the smartest child you will ever meet in the world, was not admitted to our honors college. And he was convinced that we had not admitted his child because he was only 13 years old. The child is profoundly gifted. Apparently that is a term of art that I had not come across before. And will graduate from high school this spring. He's been admitted to Penn State. But he is not allowed to live in the dorms. So we didn't decline him because of his age. He just wasn't quite there academically. We, at the Honors College Penn State, we had 3,700 applications for 300 spots. It's highly competitive. But yet somehow Dad thought that it's no big deal to live in the dorms as a 13, 14-year-old. And it was interesting because his essays, I went back and looked at them, and his essays showed that he simply was not yet very mature. He was smart. And when it came to things of mathematics and so forth, he was very clever, but he was not very mature. So he may know a lot, but he's not yet experienced very much. And I think that sort of sums up my undergraduate experience. There we go. I'm still not terribly mature. But as he said, I did my undergraduate here, and I did. I started out chemistry. It's not their fault. It's my own fault. Oh, thank you, Carl. Mic stand cometh.
The only one that's not clear to me that it does. There you go. You got it?
No. That's all right. Thank you. So, long story short, I ended up in history and Near Eastern studies. I was, to the best of my knowledge, the first student to graduate with any degree in religious studies. I agitated with a couple of other faculty members to get the religious studies program created, which is now fairly robust, as I understand it. And I graduated with a minor because my parents had given me an extra semester and that was it. They were very, very generous. One of the things I really wrestled with when I realized I didn't want to be a physician and I didn't want to spend all that time in university. You can do the math. PhD was granted in 2000. But I was wrestling with calling and trying to figure out whether or not I felt God was calling me to ministry in an ordained capacity or otherwise. And I said to the folks at dinner tonight, one of the things that struck me while here was we had folks like Dick Baer and Bob Fay, who were very engaged with us in InterVarsity, but were in the sciences more or less. I mean, Dick sort of straddles them. And I had great faculty mentors in history who were very active in their Catholic parish, but I wasn't Catholic. And I found real challenges as I was learning more and more academically about the Bible, and I had no one to talk with about that. I mean, I had lots of great peers and roommates. I remember finally figuring out with my roommate Jeff Howard what Christocentric soteriology meant. I'm like, oh, Christ-centered theory of salvation. Well, why didn't he say so? Anyway. Kind of inside baseball, I suppose. But anyway, I now throw out words like that all the time and sound like a complete jerk. But that process of discernment continues to continue. But as I went through it, long story short, I ended up taking the academic track. I ended up, by God's grace, purely because it was the day before our wedding. We were headed to University of Toronto. Day before the wedding, my master's supervisor said, friend just called. They've got a one-year scholarship for a one-year graduate program at the University of Oxford in England. Do you want to go? Okay, I'm getting married tomorrow. I should probably ask Elizabeth. Yeah, you might want to ask Elizabeth. So all of that is to get to the doctorate. those of you who are doctoral students or have done them yourselves, you know that you end up often doing whatever it is that your advisor is doing or something in that area. What has captivated me most of my life is how people interpret Scripture. I grew up in a Presbyterian church. It's now part of the EPC, Evangelical Presbyterian Church, with a great expository preacher, Dick Halverson. Rob Norris is the pastor now, getting ready to retire after 32 years. Had lunch with him 2 days ago. But that just drew in me. So that's where my interest, my academic interest and everything went. And I sat down with my doctoral advisor at Oxford, and I said, you know, I really kind of would like to do church fathers, but I want to be in a secular setting. And, you know, church fathers, it's mostly going to be Catholic schools and things like that. And he said, well, look, the rabbis are doing the same sort of stuff. They're just rabbis. They're Jewish. They're doing it in that context. And he said, I'm working on this text called the Targum of Lamentations. So Lamentations, you all know, it's the book of the Bible. It's five poems lamenting the destruction of Jerusalem. Targum is a rabbinic text that is the it's a translation. It's a sui generis. It's a unique kind of translation of the biblical text that incorporates commentary. The point is, I then spent my first dozen years or so of academic publication researching and writing on Lamentations, and mostly Jewish and rabbinic responses, but also Christian responses and contemporary Jewish and Christian responses to lament, catastrophe. So I actually have 12 pages of script, and I've touched none of it yet, but it's mostly just citations and things. All of that became rather relevant 2 and a bit years ago on New Year's Eve when our son, who had been sick for 30 hours with a fever, died. It was sepsis. It was a blood infection. We've since learned that basically there's nothing you can do. Once you know the infection is there, unless you're already in the hospital, receiving treatment already, you're basically gone. And so we take it as a blessing that we didn't know, and that he was only actually in the hospital for a very few hours, and that we were able to be with him and hold him. But we, as a result, obviously, as you can imagine, it's become very personal. And so I've gone back and thought afresh. But I have to say, with not a whole lot of different conclusions necessarily, to contrast this with someone you might have heard of. Any of you have heard of Bart Ehrman? So Bart Ehrman, who's written Misquoting Jesus and a bunch of things, that basically he makes text criticism sexy. He says stuff that text critical scholars have known, biblical scholars have known for hundreds of years, that there are variances between manuscripts and so forth and so on, and he makes it sexy and sells books. Bart and I were, he came to speak at Penn State, and Gary Knopper is a friend, and Bart and I sat down for drinks afterwards, and we talked about the fact that somebody had asked him why he now considers himself an atheist. And he said he had gone to Moody and grew up very conservative, and he said he was teaching, and a student asked him, basically, why do bad things happen to good people? How do you explain, how do innocent people die? Kids like Mac. And he said, I realized I had no explanation for it. And I got to say, I sat there across the table from him, and I thought, really? You got all the way through to your late 20s. You've got all the way through a doctorate and graduated, and it never occurred to you that in this world, there are people who are blameless, who die, who suffer atrocious things through no direct fault of their own. But that was it for him. But it wasn't for me, and I guess I can't be too harsh, because I, as I said, I was wrestling with this partly because of academics. But anyway, so one of the things I found often when I would look at particularly Christian writings, and I'm going to try not to get too doctrinal on different positions here, but I'm happy to go hammer on tongs as much as people want on some of this. But I've often heard, and in fact there's a little track called Toward a Biblical Theology of Suffering, and the very first sentence is, suffering is God's plan for us. So I want to begin by rejecting that. Now, there are New Testament passages that encourage us as Christians to be strong in the face of persecution, that suffering increases our perseverance, and to remind us that we suffer even as Christ has suffered, no doubt, and I'll come to those at the end. But to say that suffering is God's plan for us, I think is wrong, and I think it's quite hurtful. I think if we want to understand a biblical view of hardship and suffering, we have to first begin with God's plan. We need to start with the creation and the fall. And God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was tov me'od. It was very good. So God's plan was for a heaven and an earth where the creatures on, beneath, and above the earth, that we were all in harmony with one another and with God. And it was tov me'od. It was very good. In Genesis 2, the Bible describes God placing man in the garden to till it and to keep it. There was pleasure, there was joy, there was purpose and fulfillment. I heard Tony Blair, I was living in England when he was elected PM, and he used that passage that the man was put in the garden to till it and to keep it, to say that work was a fundamental human right. We were created to do work. The bit that was all good. The bit I think he missed in his homily on BBC One was to say that, and it was not a hardship to do work. That's the nature of God's intent for us, God's plan for us. It was a pleasure, it was a joy. There was purpose, there was fulfillment in doing those things. Now, it's true. God saw that it was not good for the man to be alone, so he made the woman. But suffering and grief were not part of that plan. Now, you could say I'm being pedantic with the use of the term plan, and I am, but, you know, you can't have a bonfire without a straw man now and then. But I hope I'm not being quite so disingenuous, and it's okay to laugh at me, please. But I do think it's really important. Because I do think that there is this suggestion out there that everything is designed and orchestrated for a purpose. And I do think, and I know, that God did ordain, design, and create this world for a purpose. But the world we now live in is a world that we helped to create. Because our creative act was in taking and eating. He said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you not to eat?" So at this point, whether you're a Calvinist or an Arminian, there is general agreement that the act of the man and the woman in the garden disregarding God's command to not eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that was an act of free will. It was not God's plan that they should rebel in this way, but so that they might love him fully and without condition. The opportunity for such rebellion was necessary. Now, we could go down all sorts of other rabbit trails there. I once taught a semester-long class on Genesis 1 through 3, and I barely made it into Genesis 3 before the last week of class. There's so much in these opening chapters. But that's our creative act, right? That's humanity taking what God had planned and turning it for something different. And that's why Genesis 3:16 onwards, that explains our world. To the woman he said, "I will greatly increase your pangs in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." To the man he said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have not eaten, and have eaten of the tree about which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you," etc., etc. That is all language of suffering and pain. That is language of struggle, and it is a curse. It is not what we were designed for. It's not the world that God created. But it is the world we live in. We live in a broken and fallen world. We are no longer in the garden. We're no longer in that peace and harmony, that comfort. They're with us. Peace, comfort, and harmony are with us, but they're fleeting. But when they come, they are reminders of God's love and his grace for us. But they're also a reminder of how far we've come. I do think it's an encouragement, too, because it reminds us that someday, when we are once again reconciled with God through Christ, we will be reunited with him and we shall know what that's like, that peace, that harmony, without the suffering. So suffering is now an inherent trait of human existence. It's not God's design, it's a choice we made and we continue to make. So recognizing this fact, I think, leads us sometimes too quickly to go to an error of the opposite sort. to declare that once one is a Christian, we should never suffer. To be honest, I've got like two sentences here because I don't think there's a whole lot to do with that. I mean, there are some who think that, and I just I see no reason, no justification. We are a part of this world, right? We're told that again and again. Jesus tells us that, Paul tells us that, and that means that we will suffer and struggle as the world does too. If we are truly faithful and actively seeking out, not going down that way. So I think that I will simply note in closing on that, Jesus was explicitly doing the Father's will, and yet he suffered grievously unto death. I think that serves for it. So, this is a reality that includes illness, hunger, poverty, suffering, and death. That's where we live. That's what it is. Now, we are fortunately fairly isolated in our world, right? We know that. We now live in a town called Happy Valley. I mean, not literally State College, but, you know. Ithaca is not exactly that far removed from it. But we know that this is the world, and it does not take much. It takes very little, and often completely out of our control, to bring that reality home to us. So I think the issue, and this is what I kind of want to walk us through, the question is, from a biblical perspective, how are we to understand our suffering, understanding where it comes from, and what do we do with it once it arrives in our lives? So, since suffering is nothing new, it's not surprising that we find many texts and passages in the Bible that deal with the subject. As Christians, as I suggested, I think we too often focus on New Testament passages where they emphasize the value of persevering through whatever hardship or suffering may occur. As a side note, I've got this book that someday I'll finish once I get the book done for promotion to full, called Characters of God, where I think as Christians we're so conditioned by the Gospels. We have the example of Jesus, who's perfect, and Paul, who's telling us the new law, basically, this is what you're to believe, and this is how we're to behave in community, and so forth and so on, that I think we often have a hard time reading and understanding the Hebrew narrative. So you take, for example, Jacob and Esau and Jacob's mom, right? Okay, so the prophecy comes that Jacob is to rule, but do we really think that God intended it to happen through the conniving and basic lying and cheating that Jacob did? Well, the text doesn't say this isn't the right way to do it. We've got to read carefully through that. And I think the same thing, we have to take the same kind of caution when we're looking at the New Testament when it comes to these discussions, because Paul's letters, Revelation, and certainly Jesus in the Gospels, but the later texts, they are writing to a community that is largely under persecution. Sometimes kind of low level. It may just be the families, being outcast from the families. But they are in a situation different from ours, but not different from others in this world. And I think, of course, tragically, of those in Kenya, right, who were targeted at the college, and was it 140-some that were murdered? So in those kind of contexts, the New Testament, I think, still speaks powerfully there. But we have to be careful, as with all exegesis, when we look at a text before we apply it directly to ourselves. So as I said, I'll come to some of the New Testament texts at the end. But when we look at the Old Testament, I think there is a rich, deep vein that we often don't tap. And I think this is a larger issue as an aside. And I realize, you know, these are all huge, broad brush strokes. But it is amazing if you look at, and I haven't set foot in a physical Christian bookstore. Do they still exist? I mean, you know, everything's sort of Amazon and CBD, Christian book distributors and everything else. So I can tell you in Happy Valley we don't have a Christian bookstore. But I know when I go online and I look at what's there, it's so much of it are sort of the greeting card kind of formula. So let's look at the Old Testament then. All right, let's start there. One of the things I think, the places to start right away is Genesis 4. We're out of the garden now, and you've got Cain and Abel. Right? Again, God allows Cain the choice. Right? He's jealous. We don't exactly know why. But God says, if it goes well with you, you know, all will be well. And But you must be careful because sin is crouching at the tent flap. Don't give in to it. Hey, he gives in. That shouldn't be so flippant. Abel was killed. That's not a good thing, right? But sin is still active in the world, and his choice is still active in the world. And he took that choice, and he brought that suffering, that hardship there, not just to his brother, but to himself and to his parents. Joseph's generation, or Noah's generation, and then we get Joseph's brothers and the way they treated him. You know, all of this, the wickedness of humankind, that's the line in Genesis 6 before God says, all right, this is it. I'm going to get a clean slate. So we're going to jump on to Deuteronomy, because Deuteronomy is at the heart of one of the most challenging sort of presentations of suffering, because you find in Deuteronomy 28 when you get the affirmation of the covenant. You'll recall Deuteronomy is kind of a retelling of the law. They're getting ready to go into Canaan. Moses knows he's not gonna make it, and so he wants to recapitulate. If you will only obey the Lord your God by diligently observing his commandments that I'm commanding to you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. All these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you if you obey the Lord your God. And then it lists all sorts of blessings. So if you obey the Lord, you will be blessed. But if you will not obey the Lord by diligently observing those commands, a lot of repetition, great if you want to learn Hebrew, by the way. They repeat the same words over and over and over again. If you will not obey the Lord your God, the Lord will send upon you disaster, panic, and frustration in everything you attempt to do until you are destroyed and perish quickly. It seems really straightforward, right? If we're obeying God's law, if we're doing the things that God wants for us, all will be well, we will be blessed, and things will go well, right? How many books and titles can we think of and sermons that we've heard and whole careers, Joel Osteen, that we know of that preach this kind of gospel? It's just not that simple, right? That's not to say that Deuteronomy isn't serious, that God is not serious in saying you need to obey my commandments and you need to obey my laws, but we can't say every catastrophe is a result. If I don't mean to make it personal, but my son died. I'm not perfect, right? My wife isn't perfect. My son wasn't perfect, but he was 2 weeks shy of 9 years old. I don't think there was a cause and effect of disobeying God's law somewhere in there that led to his death. Okay? The other thing I would say, that's for a nation. Right? This is God's message to the nation of Israel, corporately, as the nation of Israel. This is the message. If as a nation you will do these things. Can I get political for just 1 minute? Because I really wasn't political as a student here. I mean, maybe a little bit. That's something that a lot of folks don't remember today in today's contemporary political commentary when we're talking about the Bible and Christian nation, this and that and the other thing. It's really important just to remember we are not the B'nai Israel. That doesn't mean we shouldn't still follow God, but it means we got to work a little harder on our exegesis before we can say this passage or that passage applies to this nation or that nation. So that's just my, okay. If you want to get up and leave now, that's fine. But that's got to be the least political commentary you've heard at this institution in a long, long time. But anyway, so this, what we call the Deuteronomic theology, this Deuteronomic worldview is really important in Israel's history. The prophet Jeremiah, so we're going to fast forward now. We're going to get to the 6th century. 7th and 6th century, remember Jerusalem gets destroyed in 586 by the Babylonians. The prophet Jeremiah, which this is great because Jeremiah is one of the few biblical figures in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, that scholars pretty much say, yes, there was this guy Jeremiah. Yes, he said at least most of this. Yes, he really did live before, during, and after the destruction of Jerusalem. Jeremiah picks up that language. Jeremiah says to Jerusalem and Judah that when the Babylonians are laying siege to Jerusalem, Nebuchadnezzar is God's instrument of judgment, and that through him God is punishing the nation for their disobedience. So Jeremiah chapter 2, right towards the beginning. Why do you complain against me? You have rebelled against me, says the Lord. So Israel going, oh God, how can you have this come upon us, blah, blah, blah. I shouldn't say it that way because it was horrific. And God's saying, why are you complaining? I told you this would happen, right? You have rebelled against me, says the Lord. In vain I struck down your children. They accepted no correction. Your sword devoured your prophets like a ravening lion. I sent prophets and messengers to bring you in line. You just killed them. And you, O generation, behold the word of the Lord. Have I been a wilderness to Israel or a land of thick darkness? Why then do my people say, we are free, we will come to you no more? In other words, I tried to work with you folks. I really, really did. In fact, other prophets use the metaphor of a divorce, right? I tried to work with you. I wanted to go to counseling. You refused to come to counseling. We're just at an impasse now. This has to happen. Or in 27, in the beginning of the reign of King Zedekiah, son of Josiah of Judah, this word came to Jeremiah from the Lord. Thus the Lord said to me, make yourself, I love this one. You know this passage? Make yourself a yoke of straps and bars and put them on your neck. So he's physically putting on this yoke, right? In fact, we've got sort of a yoke right there, right? You've got that kind of thing up there, except it would be an oxen yoke that'd be wider. And he's physically putting this on. I taught a course on women in the Hebrew Bible once and allowed students to do creative fiction. And one of my students wrote from the perspective of Jeremiah's wife. She's like, honey, what is that thing around your neck? God told me to put it on. Send word to the king of Edom, the king of Moab, the kings of the Ammonites, the kings of Tyre, the king of Sidon, by the hand of the envoys who have come to Jerusalem to King Zedekiah of Judah. But if any nation or kingdom will not serve this king, Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, and put its neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon, then I will punish that nation with the sword, with famine, and with pestilence, says the Lord, until I have completed its destruction by his, Nebuchadnezzar's, hand. So two quick things I can't help but digress. One is, notice the universalism here. I don't mean, you know, like Unitarian universalism. I mean, this message goes not to the king of Judah. It goes to all the other kings of the region. Yahweh, God, is saying, I don't care whether you worship me or not. I'm letting you know I'm in charge and Nebuchadnezzar is my man. And I'm doing something through him. Now, one of the things I wrestled with, or I read other people wrestling with in my research, and within the Jewish context, is many, many Orthodox theologians, and even some to this day, look at this example and say Hitler was God's ordained agent of judgment because Jews had become too secularized. Jews had become Christians. They had left the traditions. They had left the law. They had disobeyed God's commands. I have nothing more than to share with you that that's a root of thinking, and you can understand why, but that also probably feels a little uncomfortable for you, as it does for me. And it's understandable then too, right? You'll recall Jerry Falwell, after 9/11, he said, quote, the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who have tried to secularize America caused this to happen. He saw it directly. I guess I did have another politicization in there, sorry. But, you know, he saw, Falwell and others saw this as a direct judgment. I think exegetically we've got some challenges there, but we do have to acknowledge Falwell, those Orthodox theologians, they're being consistent. They may be too simplistic in drawing too straight a line, but there is a consistency there. And all of this is to say, as literary critics like to do, I'm saying all this to say we have to problematize the issue, right? I'm trying to put it forward so that we can see at the face it looks simple. Follow God's laws, we'll be blessed. Disobey God's laws, we'll be punished. If I've been punished, therefore I haven't obeyed God's laws. Right? Somebody who does philosophy can tell me what there's a name for that and I can't remember what it is. That seems logical, that seems to follow, and we, like, what's the debate? Brady, why don't you just sit down and be quiet now? Well, because once we start to really apply it, we begin to realize this, it gets complicated. So let's move to Lamentations. Now, the book of Lamentations gives voice to those who survived the atrocity of the siege of Jerusalem. And this was, some historians say it was as long as 2 years long, a besiegement of Jerusalem. By all accounts, it was horrific. So chapter 1, there are five distinct poems. I've just got some from chapter 1 and some from chapter 2. This is Jerusalem personified. Her uncleanness was in her skirts. She took no thought of her future. Her downfall was appalling, with no one to comfort her. O Lord, look at my affliction, for my enemy has triumphed. Enemies have stretched out their hands over all her precious things. She has even seen the nations invade her sanctuary, those whom you forbade to enter your congregation. Zion stretches out her hands, but there is no one to comfort her. The Lord has commanded against Jacob, and his neighbors should become his foes. Jerusalem has become a filthy thing among them. The Lord is in the right, for I have rebelled against his word. But hear, all you peoples, and behold my suffering. My young women and young men have gone into captivity. So the poet here is speaking powerfully and eloquently about the suffering and grief that they endured. There's just this overwhelming description again and again and again about how much they suffered. But then there are moments when it's acknowledged that Judah sinned and that the Lord is in the right for punishing her. But then again, the poet reminds us and reminds God of the innocent who suffer. 2:11, my eyes are spent with weeping, my stomach churns, my bile is poured out on the ground because of the destruction of my people, because infants and babes faint in the streets of the city. They cry to their mothers, where is bread and wine? As they faint like the wounded in the streets of the city, as their life is poured out on their mother's bosoms. Look, O Lord, and consider, to whom have you done this? Should women eat their offspring, the children they have born? Should priest and prophet be killed in the sanctuary of the Lord? The young and the old are lying on the ground in the streets. My young women and my young men have fallen by the sword. In the day of your anger, you have killed them, slaughtering without mercy. So where are we? Well, we are in real life. This is what really happens. And the poet, the theologian, is trying to figure this out. Yes, Lord, we sinned. Oh my, I cannot comprehend what we've just gone through. We sinned, but this is horrific. How do we reconcile? And so rather than reconcile it, the poet simply puts it all down. The rabbis, by the way, in the Targum, the text I spent way too much time on, actually I spent too much time playing Marathon, which is the precursor to Halo. But the interesting thing about the Targum doesn't find offensive the destruction of Jerusalem. The Targum finds offensive the biblical author's language of accusation against God. And so that becomes softer or problematized. It distances God from that action. So we've got this covenant between Israel and God. We've got our stipulations, blessings and curses, and we have the apparently inevitable results that God had ordained long ago, says Lamentations 2, verse 17. So the poet of Lamentations does not reject this conclusion, but he insists that we confront the atrocity of it, the horror of cannibalism and the slaughter of innocents. The portion of Lamentations that most of us know as Christians, and by the way, in the Revised Common Lectionary, it's the only bit that actually is in the entire lectionary, is from chapter 3. The thought of my affliction and homelessness is wormwood and gall. My soul continually thinks of it and is bowed down within me. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore will I hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul that seeks him. It is good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. Now, chapter 3 is a very different tone, and this really isn't intended to be a talk about Lamentations, but it is a very different tone, and in my opinion, it was written later. It shows all sorts of hallmarks of a distance reflection upon the events, whereas 1, 2, 4, and 5 you read it and you just feel the horror. These people still, it's seared in their minds. This is not something they saw on newsreels. This is where they were in Manhattan on September 11th, 2001, right? But we find that transition that says that suffering, the faithful response to suffering is to accept it and wait patiently and quietly for the Lord. Verse 27, it is good for one to bear the yoke in youth, to sit alone in silence when the Lord has imposed it. But while the poet insists that the active hand of Jerusalem's discussion is the Lord, he also states that this is not how God intended to treat his people. So the poet goes on to say, for the Lord will not reject forever, although he causes grief, he will have compassion, according to the abundance of his steadfast love, for he does not willingly afflict or grieve anyone. That's 3:33. So there we have what would seem to be a clear-cut argument. We sin and we suffer as God punishes us. It is not God's plan for us to suffer. He does not willingly afflict us, but we bring it upon ourselves. All seems to flow. Deuteronomy, Jeremiah, Lamentations. And then we get Ecclesiastes and Job. So, Ecclesiastes, I think, the best way to consider Ecclesiastes is as a Gedanken experiment, a thought experiment. What do people gain from all the toil at which they toil under the sun? Chapter 1, verse 3. So Kohelet, or the teacher, Kohelet wrestles with this question, and anybody read in the last year Ecclesiastes? Wow, that's impressive. Can I encourage you not to read it on a plane? I was getting ready to work on an article, and I had to travel somewhere. I thought, oh, it's short. I'll read it on the flight between State College and Philadelphia, which is always bumpy in little planes. And I'm sitting here, vanity, vanity. And we'll get to the passage. To what end? Everybody goes to the same end. They all die in the same. All right. I just put it away. It's a tough book to read. It's little, but it's tough. So consider this from the end of chapter 3. Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, wickedness was there as well. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for he has appointed a time for every matter and for every work. I said in my heart with regard to human beings that God is testing them to show that they are but animals. For the fate of humans and the fate of animals is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath or spirit, ruach, and humans have no advantage over the animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and all turn to dust again. Who knows whether the human spirit goes upward and the spirit of the animal goes downward to the earth? So I saw that there is nothing better than that all should enjoy their work, for that is their lot. Who can bring them to see what will be after them? Okay, good night. I mean, really, it doesn't get much better through the rest of the book, as you recall, those of you especially who have read it recently. He just keeps working and working, and he doesn't really ever answer his question, who knows whether the human spirit goes up, etc. Without anything other than affirming the assertion that there is nothing better than that all should enjoy their work. Eat, drink, and be merry. That's hardly what we would expect from our preacher or teacher. Certainly I never heard my pastor when I was a student here give us such a message like that and say, amen, and walk away, right? The teacher, well, where are the words of encouragement, right? That's what we want. We want the words of encouragement. We want the words of hope. We feel that we've got halfway through this. But the teacher, the Kohelet, is much more practical and offers us the worldview, I think, of an agnostic. What happens when I look at the world? And okay, I think there's a God, and maybe there's going to be justice at some point, but this is what I have, this is what I know. The people who've gone before, nobody remembers them. Nobody's going to remember me in the future. I can't know the future, so what does the world look like? All this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God, whether it is love or hate, one does not know. Everything that confronts them is vanity, since the same fate comes to all, to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to those who sacrifice and those who do not sacrifice. As are the good, so are the sinners. Those who swear are like those who shun an oath. It's the world we live in. So do we affirm the words of the teacher? It's canon, right? It's there. It's in our Bible. We may not like it. I don't know. I mean, let's see. Luther didn't like James. Did he like Ecclesiastes? I don't know Luther well enough. I think, you know, are they designed and presented precisely to show us the despair that comes from a theology that is purely based upon natural revelation? Excuse me, natural observation rather than revelation? And that's one possibility, right? I just, as I said, you know, that if we only can do, you know, make do with what we can see and test of our own, right? We were talking earlier about a certain prominent faculty member here that I've had clashes with, who is an ardent and aggressive atheist. And, you know, his argument usually boils down to, look, what I can verify, what I can see and know, that's what is reality. Okay, if that's your reality, I think Ecclesiastes makes a pretty good job of saying, it sucks. Sorry, that's kind of rude. I mean, it is rude, but I think, so maybe that's one way we're supposed to read it. Maybe. In the end, Kohelet concludes, the end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for that is the whole duty of everyone. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. I got to tell you, as a literary critic, as somebody studying this text as literature, you read the whole thing and then you get to, like, you, oh no. Okay, either A, somebody else stuck that on there because they didn't like what you had to say either. Or you copped out. And you made all your argument, and then you thought, I don't have time to finish this essay. It's due at 8 in the morning. At the end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God, keep his commandments. Drop the mic, you know? I think in the end, though, this kind of direct and unflinching gaze at our life is necessary. And I suppose I've sounded a little bit like Kohelet up until now tonight. And I'm going to keep going on that vein a little bit, but this is our human experience. Any theology of suffering and grace has to include the very real experience of hopelessness and meaninglessness that we all at some point experience. So that brings us to Job, right? Job is our locus classicus for the problem, most simply stated as, why do bad things happen to good people? So some of you know Rabbi Kushner's book by that same name. I remember a couple months after our son died, my wife was reading it, and she said, oh, Rabbi Kushner says this. I said, I know. Rabbi Kushner says that. I know. Why do you say you know? Why do you pretend as if you... I said, honey, I read it 15 years ago. You know, and he's right. I mean, if you haven't read that, by the way, it is a great little book to help us all think through these challenges. And if you don't know his story, his son, I can't remember the name of the disease, someone here I'm sure will remember it, but his son was diagnosed fairly early with this degenerative disease, so he became, basically, he ages hyper fast, like some sort of horrific Star Trek episode, and he died, progeria, and he dies, I think, at 14 or 15, but they had 6 or 7 years of, on the one hand, 6 or 7 more years with him, and we would give anything to have more years with our Mac, but at the same time, they watched him slowly die. And he talks about how he was a horrible, he said, I realize now I was a horrible rabbi before I went through that. But he talks about all sorts of things that he, you know, like he overheard, you know, a person genuinely trying to comfort a fellow Christian when her son died and saying to her, you know, God never gives us more than we can handle. And the mother replied, so if I hadn't been so strong, Bobby would have survived the surgery. You know, but we say these sorts of things all the time without really thinking it through. So I think this kind of unflinching gaze is necessary. So Job is of course, the sort of the classical text for this, right? Job's incredibly faithful to God, and he is blessed. He has animals beyond number, numerous sons, great wealth, and daughters. Yet death and destruction come upon the entire family. He becomes deathly ill, left only with his wife and a group of friends without whom he might have been better off. Yeah. Curse God and die, right? I once heard a paper on how his wife saying to him, curse God and die, wasn't really her being mean and nasty, because it was somebody really trying to rehabilitate Mrs. Job. And I'm completely sympathetic with it, but you still end up with Mrs. Job saying to him as he's scratching his boils with a pot sherd, why don't you just curse God and die? I don't know how you retranslate that as to anything other than what it really is. So that's the setup. And you know, I was going to intentionally not mention the preface. So if you've read Job, you know there's a preface, right? Satan, or God is with the heavenly court, and Hasatan, the accuser, comes in from roaming around the earth, and God says to him, hey, by the way, have you seen Job? Isn't he awesome? He rocks. He's totally faithful. He constantly is offering the sacrifices and stuff, and he's just awesome. And Hasatan, the accuser, says, duh. You've blessed him with everything. His life is great and wonderful. You put a little hardship on his life, he's out of there. He'll curse you, he'll reject you. So the preface sets the whole thing up as a test. But I actually think we need to set that aside, not because of whether or not it might have been written later or this or that. Job doesn't know about the preface. That's the reason why we should ignore it. But so that you didn't think I was ignoring it, I wanted to tell you that we're going to ignore it. Okay. So Eliphaz, my boy. How happy is the one whom God reproves? Therefore, Job, do not despise the discipline of the Almighty, for he wounds, but he binds up. He strikes, but his hand heals. He will deliver you from six troubles. In seven, no harm shall touch you. You know, this is real encouraging stuff. And remember, the whole time Job's sitting there going, I did not deserve this. There is by the way, in case you haven't read it in a while, there is some question as to whether or not his sons deserved it, right? Because they would go out and party and do all sorts of stuff, and dad would offer all these extra sacrifices on their behalf in case they forgot because they were out partying and doing other things. But Job himself, there's never any question in the book as to whether or not Job deserved this. He doesn't. So this is the standard response to suffering that we might expect from a Deuteronomic theology. Eliphaz is convinced that there is no way that Job is innocent. Think now, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. You are suffering, therefore you must have done some really bad stuff. Come on, Job, be honest. Think about it, share it, and you'll feel better. You know, and God will forgive you. If you ask for forgiveness, let it out. But we know, as does Job, that there is no justification for his suffering. He's done nothing to deserve this. Teach me, and I will be silent. Make me understand how I have gone wrong. How forceful are honest words, but your reproof, what does it reprove? Do you think that you can reprove words as if the speech of the desperate were wind? In other words, I'm open, buddy. Teach me. Help me understand how this is possible. But so far, you're not. It's not. What you're saying is not true, and it's not helping. So Job recognizes and knows that he is as innocent as anyone can be. And of course, again, God affirms that for us. So we do have the preface, and in the preface, God does say he's totally innocent. And the only reason this is happening is because God's allowing it. That's a whole other issue. But anyway, he pushes back against his friend's words and even reminds us of Ecclesiastes. This is, again, from chapter 6. But now be pleased to look at me, for I will not lie to your face. Turn, I pray, let no wrong be done. Turn now, my vindication is at stake. Is there any wrong on my tongue? Cannot my taste discern calamity? Do not human beings have a hard service on earth, and are not their days like the days of a laborer? So how, you know, this is the nature of life. It is hard, but show me, teach me, what have I done wrong? So how is this helpful to us? Are we, or Elizabeth and I, so faithful that God and Satan can decide to test us to see if we will... Elizabeth's my wife, by the way. I should have pointed that out. Are we so faithful, like Job, that Satan and God can decide to test us to see if we will remain faithful? And then that makes Mac nothing more than a pawn. And now Mac was not... He was not out partying late at night requiring me to offer sacrifices on his behalf, okay? Should we imagine that there's a celestial court sitting around considering our fate? I don't think so. And I do think it's another reminder that we can't blithely take biblical narrative or passage and attempt to overlay it directly onto our own or someone else's life. So Job consistently and insistently maintains his innocence. He demands a reply from God, an explanation for the reason for his grief and suffering. And finally, God answers Job. And what is God's answer to Job? What's that?
Who are you?
Who are you? Any other offers of answers? I mean, you're right, he begins with, who are you? God's answer to Job is, you are not God. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind, gird up your loins like a man. I will answer you, and you declare to me, will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be justified? Have you an arm like God, and can you thunder with a voice like this? The pit of despair. Princess Bride reference, thank you. Deck yourself with majesty and dignity. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. Pour out the overflowings of your anger and look on all who are proud and abase them. Look on all who are proud and bring them low. In other words, when you can be a God, we can talk. But Job, you're not God. I'm checking, and I think I still am. Can you tame Behemoth? Can you control Leviathan? Can you pull him up out of the sea? No. And Job seems satisfied. I have wondered about that for a long time. Long before we came upon our own Job-like experience. God does not, and I've read that so carefully, God does not answer a single one of Job's questions or complaints or concerns. Other than, at the end, he turns to Job's friends and goes, Y'all are just wrong. And you need to go ask Job to offer sacrifices on your behalf, otherwise I'm taking you down. Right? That's about the only thing that Job gets from God in terms of direct response. He justifies Job by telling the boys they were wrong. So why is Job satisfied? I think it's because God spoke to him. And there are plenty of days when I can tell you, if he would just say something, I'd be satisfied. To me, that's the biggest challenge I find with Job in my current life situation. To hear something. Now I can step back and I can say, well, the reality is, my experience is lots of people, some of whom are related to some people in this room, came to be with us in our grief, continue to call us and be with us. Two of my Cornell friends called me this past weekend because it was Easter. It was Good Friday, and they thought about us, and they prayed for us, and they reached out to us. And on that level, I know that God is speaking to us through them. But man, I would love to hear that voice peal like thunder. You know, it doesn't even have to be Cecil B. DeMille. There's a throwback. Job's message, I think, is not one of comfort and consolation. There is simply the knowledge that God spoke. And we have to find that. We have to listen. Even, right, the whirlwind, and then it's the whisper that comes. I always get my Elijah and Elisha mixed. It was Elijah, right? Looking at the pastors, yeah. All right, so what do we do then? So I've just described, I've brought us all down. We're all kind of sad and depressed, and this guy is really just, he's a downer. Move him on. This is the world we live in. This is kind of the theological landscape we find ourselves in. Well, the biblical view, as I said, I think is God's plan for us is to live in harmony with one another, with all of his creation, and with him. Now, I also believe separate discussion. That's what we are to be about today as God's people. Recognizing we can only do so much. God does all, but our duty is to do what we can to bring that reconciliation between one another, with God and with his creation. But we shattered that glass, and now we live in this broken world. Now, we can try and find some pattern or purpose in our suffering as a means of alleviating our pain, and I understand that. We want to find a reason for what we're going through. But what I'm suggesting is that the normal order of this world, the normal pattern, is bad things happen all the time. Now, I'm not suggesting that God may not or cannot and has not intervened or guided history, even with regard to suffering. Clearly, I hope you know by now that I believe he did most emphatically in sending his son, why? To suffer and die for us. But day in and day out, the world turns, people get sick, they suffer, they die, we mourn, and it happens all the time. I think I do a great injustice to God's grace and mercy when I try and explain Mac's death or someone's cancer as part of some grand manipulative plan. To say that God is doing that in order to teach me this lesson or to help us do this or that. As we, I think, make our way outside of the garden's gates towards the presence of God, we find that his presence is not in the infliction of our suffering, but in the grace and peace to bear it. So I don't think, I utterly reject one of my best friends who asserted that this is part of God's will. We won't understand it in this world, but Mac's death is part of God's will. I reject that. And some of you may not like me, feel comfortable with that kind of assertion. But what I do know is that God can and will and does redeem that hurt, that suffering, if we allow him to. If we ask God to be present with us as we respond to this very normal effect and happening of this broken world. Vanity, all is vanity, it seems, right? Fleeting, it just comes and goes like the morning mist. But thankfully, that's not the totality of the biblical worldview. Because when God expelled humanity from the garden, he did not abandon us. He allowed humanity to go their own way. The Lord saw that the wickedness of humankind was great in the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. This is what we do, people, when left on our own. But then God stepped in, and time again he has. So we do find in Scripture words of encouragement and hope, as well as models for bearing up under the weight of this world, even while we wait expectantly for the world to come. Now, I understand some of you have been studying Psalms, and it always comes as a little bit of surprise for people who have not really sort of systematically studied the Psalms to realize that the majority of them are Psalms of lament or complaint, right? And what I think is even more interesting is that at least I was not conditioned when I sort of first came to recognizing, you know, we sing Psalms, and I think the only Psalm I ever memorized was Psalm 23. I had a little book I found once, Moving House, that had all the little Psalms I was supposed to memorize for Sunday school, and I had 2 stickers out of 12. And my mom was my teacher, so she wasn't even giving them out for me. You know, but then you start reading them, and you realize the psalmist totally lets God have it at times. So I've debated a long time about whether or not to share this, and a good friend of mine who, we were friends here at Cornell, did his undergrad and his PhD here in Near Eastern Studies, encouraged me to share the story with you, and it was with Psalms. So when the ER doctors decided that Mac needed to be sent to a hospital with greater facilities, they flew him on the helicopter, Lifeline, we call it. Everything's a lion at Penn State, to Penn State Hershey Medical Center. It's about a 2-and-a-bit-hour drive. And so we didn't get there until sometime after midnight. I can't tell you how late it was. So a chaplain met us and took us to a quiet room. And because I had done, as part of my preparation for ordination, I had done clinical pastoral training, I knew what that meant. And we had to wait before the doctor could come out and tell us that he had died on the helicopter. And I have to tell you, the immediate thing that came to my mind is, my God, why have you forsaken me? And I didn't say it out loud, because I didn't want this woman to think that I was putting on airs, or I don't know. But honestly, that's all that kept going through my head. It's, where are you? And at Psalm 22, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me, from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but find no rest. Yet you are holy, enthroned in the praises of Israel, and you our ancestors trusted. They trusted and you delivered them. To you they cried and were saved, and you they trusted and were not put to shame. I think one of the most important and powerful things about the Psalms is that they provide us with permission to be honest with God. And if you think about it, you know, if I asked you abstractly, you'd probably think that that's one of the most fundamental things God wants from us. Not because God doesn't know, but because we need to be honest with ourselves. But how often have we felt that we aren't allowed to be angry with God? That we're not allowed to express our frustrations? And I can tell you, so I haven't been down there. They still have the, I assume the suspension bridge is still there. It's probably now all caged in so nobody jumps, right? Yeah. So I remember at one point in my college career here, I went over the bridge, and I went off where I thought I was in the woods and nobody could see me and hear me, and I just yelled at God. I was just livid, angry. I was breaking sticks, and I was just, it was incredibly cathartic, and I do kind of recommend it. And then I walked back over, and as I looked back, I could actually see one of the sticks that I had, you know, big, huge thing I had tried to break, and it was too big. And I realized I could see it because I was actually in lamplight over there, and all those people walking back and forth could see me and no doubt probably could hear me as well and thought that I was insane. And probably just, yeah, I mean, God wants all of us. And I think that's something really important that these Psalms teach us. God is big enough and tough enough to handle us getting a little ticked, you know? Now, if you go through the Psalms of Lament, you find that they've got these elements, right? You've got some structure, you've got this address, oh God, what the heck? And then you get the lament, the frustration of, you know, these are all the things that are happening. The enemies are around me, they lie about me, they cheat and so forth. And then I will trust in you, you're the God of Israel, you're the one who's delivered us from Egypt, etc. Now do this for us. We've been faithful to you, be faithful to us, and I will praise you. Right? That's the arc that it takes. Now, the one other challenge I would have there in terms of this as a template for us in dealing with our grief and suffering is you read that in Psalm 22, and it doesn't take a whole lot of verses. In our lives, that might take a whole lot of days or months or years to move from the address, as we like to say, which is the, hey, you, to the, I will praise you. And at various times, we move back and forth, and we're at different points in the psalm, at different points in our lives. But all of those elements, I think, are appropriate. So I think our response to hardship and grief does not need to be pious silence. I think outrage and anger is completely acceptable, and I think God's okay with that. He's big enough, he's strong enough, he can handle our frustration and bitterness. Most importantly, as I said, I think because God wants us to be honest with him. He wants us to include, he wants to be included in our pain. I saw my folks this week, and I said that I was kind of surprised that someone pretty close to me never asks how I'm doing or how I'm thinking about Mac or what's going on. And my mom said, well, you know, he thinks about him all the time, he cares, but he asked me why I talk about Mac, and my mom starts crying, and, you know. And Elizabeth and I, we talk and write about Mac all the time. Our daughter talks about him all the time. There are all sorts of things I could go into as to why I think that's a healthy and appropriate thing, but all I want to say is here is the silence. I'm not saying you need to now go out and share if you're somebody who generally is more quiet and reserved. I'm not suggesting everybody needs to be like me. I remember as a student, we all watched Tony Campolo videos, and Tony was always, you've got to be like me. Of course, one year he's adopting children, the next year he's working in inner city, and if we did everything Tony was doing all the time, we'd have no life. But I think we What I'm saying is we need to be honest with ourselves, honest with God, and that includes not hiding from the fact that we hurt, not hiding from the fact that this really, 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 I was going to say something I'm not going to say, stinks. How's that? Is that acceptable? Piety should never get in the way of holiness. And holiness is not about being pious. So, I think as Kohelet could not remain long in his thought experiment, I do think we shouldn't remain long in our period of anger. Right? My friend Arnie, who's also a Cornellian, he's the reason I came to Cornell. He's a psychiatrist. And Arnie's about, 16, 18 years older than I am. And I've often joked, and I joked at dinner tonight, it was really, really helpful to have a psychiatrist as a mentor when going through college and grad school and marriage and life and everything else. Arnie has said often to me, he says, it's okay. We cry every day, Elizabeth and I. Not necessarily together, but at some point in the day, we're overcome with it. We look at a picture and we just get overwhelmed or what have you. But he says, change the channel. Don't stay too long, right? Netflix just released Daredevil. We ended up watching 3 episodes last night. It's a good series. Do not watch more than 1 episode at a time. It's too much. We can't remain in those places too long. So follow the psalm. Look at that progression that's there, but know that you're not going to sit down and in 3 minutes that it takes to read the psalm, are you going to move all the way through your own grief and suffering? I think I kind of got down a particular trail there. I hope you don't mind. Well, the biblical reality is that this is a broken world in which we suffer. The biblical promise is that this world is not the entirety of reality. While the biblical reality is that this is a broken world in which we all suffer, the biblical promise is that this world is not the entirety of reality. The prophet Isaiah, looking out at Israel's own punishment and suffering, offers these words of encouragement and a glimpse of our future. On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wines, of rich food filled with marrow, of well-aged wine strained clear. And he will destroy on this mountain the shroud that is cast over all peoples, the sheet that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. Then the Lord God will wipe away the tears from all faces, and the disgrace of his people he will take away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. It will be said on that day, lo, this is our God. We have waited for him so that he might save us. This is the Lord for whom we have waited. Let us be glad and rejoice in his salvation, for the hand of the Lord will rest on this mountain. It's appropriate that we're just past Easter. The fulfillment of this promise is, of course, in Jesus. This is where our mourning turns into dancing at the resurrection of Jesus, the first of those raised. He not only confirmed that he is the Son of God and the Messiah, but that death truly has been conquered. It is no longer the end. Kohelet's questions have been answered. Our bodies may go down to dust, but we will be raised in Christ. Now, there's a lot of other things about the New Testament passages, but I think I've shared most of my thoughts there with you. So I want to just conclude with these thoughts. One of the books we were given when we were immediately grieving Mac was actually by my spiritual director, our former rector, Larry Hofer, a wonderful, wonderful man. And it's a little tiny book by a man named Granger Westberg. He had been a Lutheran pastor, worked in hospitals. I think it was originally published in the 50s. And he gets at the point that I think is imperative, which is to understand that in most cases, God has not sent the suffering to us, but rather he is with us as we respond to our suffering. It's an important distinction. And Westberg gets at this. He opens by dealing with 1 Thessalonians 4:13. I don't expect you to know it off the top of your head. I certainly didn't. But he says, too often in his ministry in hospitals, he hears other Christians saying, grieve not. As Christians, we are to grieve not. Grieve not. But then he says, you're putting the comma in the wrong spot. The verse reads, but we do not want you to be misinformed, brothers and sisters, about those who have died, so that you may not grieve as others who have no hope. So grieve not as those who have no hope. For since we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so through Jesus, God will bring with him those who have died. The promise and hope of the resurrection doesn't mean that we won't or shouldn't grieve, but it does mean that in our grieving, we may also find comfort in the knowledge that we will be with the Lord forever. Westberg concludes, so we say grieve not as those who have no hope, but please, when you have something worth grieving about, go ahead and grieve. And finally, I'll conclude last sentence to Ecclesiastes. Of anything beyond these, my child, beware. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. Thank you for your patience. I think that was long-winded and a little tiresome, but thank you all so much. You're very kind. Do we have, Justin, how much time do we have for discussion?
Yeah, so now we can open to the floor.
Please. Thank you so much for asking that. By the way, this morning I led a memorial service for a friend. He was 54, died very unexpectedly on Saturday. And another friend of his, who's actually older than both of us, he's in his early 60s, shared, I've never lost a friend before. And I have to say, my one thought is, you are so lucky. I don't know how one, and he's a very nice guy, and I'm sure he's got lots of friends. I give this as unsolicited advice all the time. Just be with them. And then if they want to talk about it, they will. And so about 9 months before Mac died, in fact, it was April 15th, our men's soccer coach at Penn State, his daughter died in a car accident. And I knew Bob because we helped to recruit students, and I was there all the time with my son, Mac. And so I had called him up ostensibly to talk about a recruit, but really I just wanted to have coffee with him and be with him. And eventually he said something about Audrey, and we talked a little bit, and then we stopped talking about Audrey, and we talked about other stuff. Just being present is all you need to be. And then if they want to talk, they will bring it up. And, you know, I think it's always completely fine to say, I know things are tough right now. Are you okay? And if they don't want to talk, they'll say, you know, it's hard, but I'm okay. Thanks. And that's your cue. You talk about work, you talk about something else. But on the other hand, if they want to share, they will. And then be engaged with them. And I really feel honest and truly, don't plan, don't worry. Pray ahead of time, absolutely. But let the conversation happen as they want it to happen. So thank you for asking me that. I wanted to share that. Yeah. The question was, would I ever consider losing my faith after this happened? Not really. I mean, I consider losing my faith every day, multiple times every day. Or you could put it the other way around, I reconfess my faith multiple times every day. I mean, it depends on which way you want to look at it, right? And I mean that in all sincerity. I mean, there have been so many other things, too. I think one of the reasons why, this is why I didn't. Because I had spent a dozen plus years wrestling with what we call theodicy. That's what we call all of this. Why do bad things happen to good people? Where is God's justice? And the only explanation, it's part of the reason why, I mean, I was never, the church I grew up in was never very doctrinal anyway. It wasn't terribly Calvinist. But it's one of the reasons why, I mean, I certainly didn't join the Episcopal Church because of its, because it's such a healthy operation right now. You know, that was a joke, by the way. We don't have any Episcopalians in the room, clearly. Okay, I'll press on with that. But the notion of a real narrow sort of God orchestrating everything kind of a theology, I realized a long time ago it doesn't fit with the biblical worldview, and it also doesn't fit with the experience of the world that I see around all the time. So I was equipped in that sense, and it was a little frustrating, I think, for my wife, as I suggested, because she was now delving into all of this for the first time, and she read voraciously, and she's got a great bibliography, by the way. If you go to macbrady.com, we set that up mostly for the website, or for there's an endowment with men's soccer at Penn State in our son's memory. Our first goalkeeper went pro this year, by the way. He was drafted by the LA Galaxy, yeah. But Elizabeth has posted a fantastic bibliography. There's a wonderful, I want to say he's a church historian, Sitzer, Jerry Sitzer. You know of Jerry? Yeah. So he lost, was it his mother, his wife, and two children, right?
I think one child.
Yeah. One child, mother and wife, in a car accident. Woltersdorf, who lost his son in a mountain climbing accident. What I didn't realize when my colleague Gary Knopper gave me the Woltersdorf slim little book, Gary later told me he had been Christopher's roommate. So he knew Christopher Woltersdorf, who died. But as Elizabeth is reading through all this, my wife, in the first 6 months or so, we share a lot what we're reading, and she would share these things, and I was not doing a very good job of sort of having it revealed to me. It was just being revealed to her. I did a lot of, I know, which was not a very good thing to do. But I had sort of worked through a lot of that. But there are still some really bad days, you know? But there's so many other things too, you know? I don't know. I that's why I just sat there dumbstruck when Bart made the comment that he never thought about this before. You know, where is God when bad things happen to innocent people? I'm thinking, dude, what world do you live in? Do you not watch television? Do you not read the newspaper? I mean, it happens all the time. So, sorry, I'm very long-winded. I apologize. Other thoughts come? And you can challenge me, by the way. I take no offense. One of my absolute best friends is from seventh grade onwards, closest friends, and Bill has become very, he's a good, solid Calvinist, and he leans more on that other direction, and we've gone at it hammer and tongs, and I take no offense by that. So please don't feel like you can't disagree with me. I'm very comfortable with disagreement. Please.
Sure, I'll ask you. So the kind of the theology of the crown pattern seems like a creator God. Like, he's not in control of those knots. He doesn't have a plan. He's just kind of working with it as it's coming. How do you kind of reconcile?
Right, so the comment, the question was that the theology that crap happens is a very neutered God, God out of control. Yes, if we ignore Genesis 3 or 2, the point being God gave us that choice, and we have to start there. I didn't just start in Genesis 1 through 3 because it's my favorite bit, or at least the bit of the Bible that I exploit the most, I use the most, but it's foundational. And we can have a whole separate question as to whether it's historical or not. It's true, right? And that truth is that humanity has rebelled, that we do that. If God didn't want us to rebel, God would have orchestrated it otherwise, right? God could have made us as automatons. God could have made us so that we were simply faithful. Regardless, I mean, we wouldn't be faithful at that point, right? Because you have to have some volition in order to be faithful. So I don't see God as being neutered. I see God as empowering. That is, God empowered us to make those choices. God empowered Cain to make those choices. And Cain made a bad choice, you know, horrific one. So I don't see God as neutered at all. I see God empowering us. I see God's grace active all the time. I would love to see even more grace. I mean, it's that difficulty, you know, when there's a car accident or a kidnapping or something, and say, well, God looked after so-and-so who survived. So God didn't care about the one who didn't survive? You know, I know that people mean it well, but we just have to be a little more sophisticated if we're really gonna wrestle with this. We've got to get below the surface on that. But no, I don't think it's a neutered God. I think it well and truly is God giving us freedom. And that freedom also includes returning to Him. Do I think God listens to prayers? Well, the old saw is that God listens to prayers, but he may not always give us the answer we want. I will be honest, I don't know what to do with that. So when they put Mac in the helicopter, we went out to get in the car, and I thought Mac would really, you know, he'd want to see the helicopter. So I took a video with my phone. It was black, all you could see were the lights. And I just cried out, I think it's a Dylan song, "Lord, protect my child." And there are plenty of moments when I have said, did I not pray hard enough? The years after I graduated from Cornell, and if somebody's in the room, forgive me, but I was on a listserv, and there was somebody on that listserv who regularly argued that Christians shouldn't die from anything other than old age. That if, as long as we have enough faith, God will heal anything and everything. I don't see that. My mother has fought lupus ever since she was pregnant with my brother in 1963. She has had, I have no idea how many operations. She has gone from one who's 5'10 to I think she's about 5'3. You know, mom is an incredibly faithful woman, surrounded by faithful people who have anointed her and prayed on her. I don't think anyone's lacking in faith there. So then we get into this, well, it's so that we can learn. This is one of my little trite phrases is I don't believe in systematic theology because the Bible's not systematic. This is one of these things where, this is one of the reasons I love the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, because it's really messy, and that's life. So I have no systematic answer for you. I have no consistent answer for you. I know that I need to pray. I know that I need to give that to God. I know that God is present with us. I don't know the details. It's very unsatisfying, I know. But. Any other questions or challenges, thoughts? Well, thank you all very much. You've been very gracious. Thank you very much.